Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's a Friday afternoon here. It might be a Friday evening where you are. It might even be a Saturday morning where you are. With that in mind, good morning to everyone in Seoul, South Korea listening. I know that at least one person is because our friend Luke listens in Seoul, South Korea. But if you're on the other side of the dateline, thank you for taking the time to listen live. And then, of course, there are lots of folks who listen later. And we're grateful for everybody who takes the time to spend some time with us. Jimmy Akin's here with us last hour and this hour to take on the questions of the internet. The internet, an endless stream of answers, but also an endless stream of questions, maybe very much like life itself. And lots of people try to get, or do in fact, get in touch with Jimmy various ways on the internet, emailing him directly or finding a way to get through us or through a chat somewhere or whatnot. And every now and then, Jimmy collects those up and we get to ask him some of those questions on the air. So if I give out the number today, it will be because I made a mistake. We're not taking calls. You can just relax and enjoy the questions that are already in. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And to the day we are recording this, we're recording this ahead of time because we will be out. I think some of the people in the radio department are going to be at a wedding for one of the boss's daughters, and various others will be other places. So we're pre-recording this. But on the day that we're doing this, I hope you don't mind me saying this, Jimmy. You told me when we started, this is the second of five broadcasts that you'll do today. Is that what you said?
Oh, well, three broadcasts, but they're each so I'm doing this pre-record for Catholic Answers, which is 2 hours. I'm doing a Weird Questions for Catholic Answers, which is another 2 hours. And I already did a podcast appearance that was over an hour. So at least 5 hours plus of radio today.
Now, with this dawn of the podcasting, there has to be more demand on your time from that, just because there's just more Catholic. Well, and you don't only do Catholic shows, of course, but there's just a lot more kind of interview type media to be doing. Is it messing with your writing or anything like that? Or you feel like,
well, I don't have as much time for writing as I did before, but it's still content creation. So whether I'm writing to create content or speaking to create content or interviewing to create content, I'm a content creator.
That's how you see it. Just get that. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so what is happening at, I mentioned that last hour, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mm-hmm. and you're going to talk about, don't tell me, it's the telepathy letters? Telepathy
tapes.
Tapes. Look at that. Why would someone do telepathy letters? That makes no sense. The telepathy tapes. You're covering that today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, but what's happening this week or any week you want to talk about as far as the Jimmy Akin podcast?
Well, so the most recent episode that came out this last Monday, I'm not 100% sure of because of how far in advance we're taping this.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But I'm currently working on a script that I have provisionally slotted for this last Monday on what everybody gets wrong about the formula faith alone, because this formula is widely misunderstood, not only in the Protestant community, but in the Catholic community too. And so I'm looking at having an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World where I talk about that, and that'll be a springboard into some additional subjects connected with justification and what the New Testament has to say about it. But we're going to start by clearing away the misconceptions involved in the formula of faith alone that everybody tends to get wrong.
Oh, very good. Very good. Yeah, that's fascinating. Sometimes I feel like you soften hearts a little bit when you go back. I feel like people harden in their positions. And I don't know if you mm-hmm. think about yourself this way, but you sometimes you have this effect of, Well, let's go back and look at the origins of this, and that can sometimes soften hearts to be like, okay, maybe there's I can do some reconsideration of my antipathy towards my fellow Christian of this persuasion or that persuasion.
Yeah, and I definitely try to look for common ground everywhere I go in apologetics, because the more common ground you have, the more you're going to get along, and the less you're going to have that you need to actually argue about.
Yeah.
So if you can clearly figure out where you don't have a problem with each other, it just helps the discussion immensely. And you know, I think I once heard something good about peacemakers, so I'm trying to trying to get in on that action a little bit if I can.
Oh man! All right. If more of us Christians would listen to that. By the way, a reference to the Beatitudes: "Blessed are the peacemakers." I got that reference. I don't always get Jimmy's references, but I got that one. This one comes from Doomsday Picnic, and Doomsday wants to know, or Mr. Picnic, I should probably be more formal. Mr. Picnic wants to know, is it more reasonable to suppose that the women who wept as our Lord was led to his crucifixion were his followers and believed in his innocence, or just onlookers moved by his pitiful condition? Many devotionals presume the former.
So they presume that they were his followers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the starting point for any question like this is, let's look at the text. This story is found in Luke chapter 23. It's down in verses 27 and 28, if you want to look it up, and here's what they say. "And there followed him a great multitude of the people and of women who were mourning and lamenting for him. But turning to them, Jesus said, 'Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children.'" And then it goes on from there, but that's the essential part. So there would seem to be a couple of competing lines of evidence that we have. The first one is the women are following along in this multitude, and they're weeping and lamenting for Jesus, they're mourning and lamenting for Jesus. That would suggest a pre-existing concern for Jesus, like they were his followers. And we know that there were women who were his followers here, because as John's gospel reveals, his own mother was there and for the crucifixion. And Luke mentions a little bit later on that there were women who had followed him here, and that actually the others all of his acquaintances were here, which is something a lot of people neglect. They make it sound like the apostles all ran away at Jesus's arrest. And then they were like cowering like dogs somewhere during the crucifixion and weren't even there except for the beloved disciple. And that is not what the Gospels say. They did run after he was arrested, but then they start regathering themselves. You know, Peter and the beloved disciple go to the high priest's house. So they were starting to regather to Jesus on the very night of the arrest. And they were not hiding somewhere in a spider hole during the crucifixion. Luke says his acquaintances were there. So we shouldn't make it sound like they were not and only John was. So, between John and Luke, we have evidence of his followers being there, including his women followers. So these could have been women who were following Jesus. But we have a countervailing piece of evidence in the same text where Jesus refers to them as daughters of Jerusalem, which would suggest that they are Jerusalemites. Now, these two categories are not exclusive. One could be both a follower of Jesus and a Jerusalemite. In fact, we know that there were people like this. For example, when just the previous day, Jesus had held the Last Supper, which was a Passover meal, at the house of a man in Jerusalem. And so we know there were Christians in the Jerusalem area even before the crucifixion. And so these women that he turns to could be both Daughters of Jerusalem and Followers of Jesus. If I were to, I would suggest that probably it was a mixed group. There were probably, because we know that he had female followers there, I would assume they would have been weeping too. And if there were Christians or even recent followers of Jesus who saw him in this pitiful condition, and that prompted them to weep and mourn, I would suggest they would be part of this group as well. So I don't think that we can establish a sort of unitary identity for this group. I think it's fair to say, based on Jesus's designation of the women, that some of them were Jerusalemites. But I think it's also reasonable, given the concern that they show, you know, mourning over him, that they were at least sympathetic to him. They didn't think he was a criminal who was getting what he deserved. And I think many of them may have been followers, either of some stand-in or even people who had just come to believe in Jesus following the events of Passion Week, where he rides into Jerusalem as the triumphant king at the triumphal entry, and then he teaches in the temple all week. And, you know, the Gospels say that people were spellbound by his teaching, so they may have been recent converts.
Doom. That may be too informal. Doomsday, Mr. Picnic, thank you very much for the question. Did I do the break, Darren? I didn't do the break yet, did I? All right,
nope.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything of the Internet Variety with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
This is Jim Pinto, director of EWTN Media Missionaries. EWTN's mission is to spread the eternal word and to teach others that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest. We got a whole bunch of questions in front of us from the internet. Internet, ask me anything for Jimmy. There does come a point in these internet, question sessions where I just start to really enjoy the names of the people. And this one comes from Mr. or Ms. RoboSquid2518. And that's just a... I don't know. Some names are just beautiful. RoboSquid2518 is one of them. If Mary was born, RoboSquid asks, without original sin, why can't everyone else?
Well, they could if God chose to preserve them from the first moment of their conception from original sin, then they would be. God is omnipotent, so he can do anything that doesn't involve a logical contradiction. It is not a logical contradiction for a person to be born free of original sin. Therefore, God could make anybody and everybody free of original sin if he chose. I suspect what RoboSquid may be asking is, well, why didn't he? And the answer there is a little more mysterious. Now, we know why he chose Mary in particular. It was to make her a more fitting mother for Jesus. It's not that he had to make Mary free of original sin. It's just that she'd be a more appropriate mother for the Son of God if she was free of original sin. And so that's why he did it for her. And he's not planning on having Jesus be born to most of us. So I guess you could say that's why he doesn't do it for most of us, because we're not going to have the same mission in life that Mary had. But you could still ask, well, why, even if we have a different mission than Mary, wouldn't it be better if we were born free of original sin? And yeah, okay, it would be better. That's definitely, you know, I think a fair assessment of things. It would be better for us if we were born free of original sin or conceived free of original sin. So this ends up boiling, but we're not. And so this ends up becoming a subcase of the famous problem of evil.
Wow.
And the general answer to every version of the problem of evil, if you say, why did God allow this evil to happen? Whether it's why did God allow us to be born with original sin or any other evil you want to ask, the general answer is God only allows evil because he's going to bring about an equal or greater good. And so there is some equal or greater good that God will bring about through the fact that most people are not born free of original sin. We can speculate on what that good is, but as the Catechism acknowledges, we may not get the answers in this life. So what I can tell you with confidence is there is some greater good that God's going to bring about as a result of the fact that most people are not born free of original sin. And you're welcome to speculate on what that good may be, but we may not find out until the next life.
RoboSquid, thank you very much for the call. This next email question. This next one comes from M.T. Mitchell. Is there any strong case, theological, biblical, and or historical, for women deacons? It seems there isn't any case, but as it gets brought up so often, what could be a strong case for it?
Strong man case.
Oh, I'm sorry. Strong man. I beg your pardon. Strong man case. Yeah.
So it depends on what you mean. Now, we know that there were women in the early church who were called deaconesses. This is clear from the New Testament itself. If you look in Romans 16:1. Paul says, I commend to you our sister Phoebe. And by saying I commend her to you, that signals she's the letter carrier. She's the one, because they didn't have a postal service in the ancient world. Actually, they did, but it was like for the Roman Empire, and it was just used by government officials and stuff. So if you're an ordinary person, you couldn't just take a letter down to the post office and mail it, because there was no public post office. What you did is you gave the letter to someone who was traveling wherever you wanted the letter to go. And you might, if you were rich and had slaves to do stuff for you, you might send a slave to carry the letter to whoever you wanted it to go to. But most people were not that wealthy, and so they would give the letter to a traveler who was already headed in that direction. And so Phoebe is the letter carrier for Romans. But that's not all that Paul says about Phoebe. He says that she's a deaconess of the church at Cenchrea, which was the port city for Corinth. And so she's called a deaconess, and it's the feminine form of the word diakonos. So we know that there were women who were called deaconesses in New Testament times themselves. Now, that doesn't necessarily amount to what we would think of as a woman deacon, because the terms for these different offices were flexible in this period, and they weren't all yet titles. Like the term for a priest that we get priest from, presbyteros, it originally just meant old man, you know, an elder. And it became a title for an office in the church. Well, in the same way, the word diakonos means servant. And so some translations, like the English Standard Version, will actually translate Romans 16:1 as Phoebe, a servant of the church at Cenchrea. And you might think, oh, well, that solves the problem, except, well, wait, what kind of servant is she? you know, so just like you could translate any of the male deacons that get referred to, you could translate that servant too. And well, they are servants of a church. But that doesn't tell us what kind of servants they are. And if there was a regular ongoing class of female servants in churches, you can call them deaconesses. And that's what we find in the early church. There were women. This wasn't just Phoebe, who was a one-off church servant. There were a bunch of women who were called deaconesses. We know that because they're mentioned in the canons that were issued by the First Council of Nicaea in 325. The Council of Nicaea is famous for infallibly defining the divinity of Christ and writing most of the Nicene Creed that we say on Sunday. The last end bit of it that deals with the divinity of the Holy Spirit, that was written by another council, but it wrote most of the Nicene Creed. What it's less famous for doing is issuing at least 20 canons or rules for governing various things happening in churches. Among others, the date of Easter was one that the Council of Nicaea dealt with. But they also mention women deacons. And what they say, though, is they're not ordained the way men are. And so we have evidence of individuals who were called deaconesses in the early church, and they did things like catechize women and perform female baptisms. And one reason you might want a woman to do that is oftentimes baptism was done naked in the early church, and you might not want a man naked baptizing a naked woman. So you might want a woman to do that baptism. We do have some evidence indicating that they were not ordained the way men were. So there was a distinction, according to some of our documents, between deaconesses and deacons. They did not both share in the sacrament of holy orders. On the other hand, there are some complexifications to all this, because it's only been recently that that the magisterium has begun treating deacons themselves as definite sharers in the sacrament of holy orders. There were various so-called minor orders like lector and acolyte and things like that that did receive orders, but it was understood to be a non-sacramental version of orders. And the question was, well, what about deacons? Where are they? Priests and bishops were definitely had the sacrament, but where did deacons go? Did they have the sacrament, or were they like the minor orders that didn't have the sacrament? And it's only been recently that the magisterium has said, okay, they definitely have the sacrament. Even that, though, that's not an infallible teaching, and so it's still debatable, but it's something that the church is not presently pursuing. It's treating deacons as if they have the sacrament. And so the question then becomes, well, what about the deaconesses? Could we revive that, and should we give them the sacrament? If so, well, we've got lots of women working in churches now. And if you wanted to just give them the title deaconess because they're performing service in the church, whether they're, an education director or an OCIA now director or whatever they're doing, they're performing service to the church. And so you could call them servants. You could give them the title diaconess without really changing anything other than the title. But that wouldn't result in them having holy orders, assuming that deacons have holy orders. Well, or the sacrament, I should say. There are individuals who argue that even though some texts distinguish women deacons from male deacons in terms of how they're ordained, there are other texts they claim that don't, that would imply that there were women who were ordained the same way men were. And I have some books written by such people. I haven't read them all yet, but I got them because I want to understand the arguments that they make. The standard opinion, however, has been that they were not ordained in the way men were. And so that's a basic sketch of the issue. But if you want a strongman or steel man version of the argument, I would say get some of the literature by advocates of women deacons, like I have, and go through it and see what arguments they muster for there being a more robust female diaconate than the common opinion is.
MT, thank you very much for that question. It's funny, we have not had many questions on women deacons, and that's certainly a question in the church these days, so it's nice to be able to get that question. If you got a question for Jimmy Akin and you want to get into one of these internet Ask Me Anythings, you can always send it to radio@catholic.com. You can also find Jimmy online in about 1 million different places. Because we love getting these questions and getting to go through them, and we'd be happy to take yours, especially if maybe you're not able to listen or maybe you're not in the United States, and get it to us by email. We'll do our best to get it on. Right back with more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers. And now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's an internet Ask Me Anything. Lots of great questions from the internet. And here's like what I'm talking about. Like Jimmy, this is from Darren, and he's in the UK. And maybe it's, we're on midnight in the UK. So that might not be a great time for him to call. Maybe wake up everybody now. So we have an email. So if that is your situation, send it to radio@catholic.com. We just forward them on to Jimmy or use one of Jimmy's many contacts. Hello.
There's an interesting, because he says he's from the UK, and there's an interesting fact about the name Darren in the UK.
Okay, I'm trying to think if I have any clue where we're going with this. Darren in the – no, I don't know. What?
Okay. So there's a popular idea that that various names become popular because of their use in media, like the name Marilyn became very common after Marilyn Monroe. And the idea was, well, the fact she was so famous helped popularize the name Marilyn. And the name Darren became common after the TV show Bewitched, included in England. And, you know, in that TV show, the main character, Samantha Stevens, her husband is Darren Stevens. And at the time, Darren was not a common name. So the popular idea is that the name Darren became popular in England because of how popular the TV show Bewitched was. But linguists who actually study baby name trends would say that's not what was happening in these situations. The name Marilyn was already growing in popularity when Marilyn Monroe became popular. That's why she picked the name, because it was an up-and-coming, hot, new, growing, popular name. And it just continued to become popular afterwards. It wasn't because of her. And in the same way, the fictional character Darren Stevens did not really promote the name Darren. Why it did become popular in English, in England, was because it's in final, meaning the final sound in the name Darren is the in sound. And Darren is one of a number of different final in sound names. And all of them were becoming popular in England at the same time. So that Darren became popular because it's in final, and it's just one of a number of different in final names. And all of the in final names, there was something about the way they sounded in the 1960s that people thought was cool. And so they started becoming more popular, including Darren. So a rising tide floats all final in name boats.
Isn't that funny? Isn't that I know linguistics is a thing that you love. You're an amateur linguist in a certain way, but that's amazing that someone did that research and found that out. Like this is just part of a wave of these. I also love how in English often names are associated to what people did, like a Miller and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So,
yep.
Was Darren like somebody who was just super Darren? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, dared to do things.
I don't think that's its origin.
Okay. All right.
But linguists do study all kinds of obscure things, not just baby names, but cuss words too. And there's some really interesting stuff about cuss words that maybe we won't go into at the moment.
Oh, why not, Jimmy? This is the perfect venue for that conversation. That's exactly what, especially moms and dads with kids in the car, like, yeah, EWTN radio.
I'll give you one in a delicate way for free.
Oh, all
now,
right.
Now, one of the worst, most tabooed words, although it's been losing a lot of its taboo recently, in English is the F word. And the F word is sometimes used in a phrase like F-U, Y-O-U. But why would you use that phrase? Well, it turns out, based on the linguistic evidence, it's actually looks like it's a substitute for a different phrase where they've subbed in the F word for an even worse word. And
well,
that
don't say that
even,
one.
That even oh no, I can say it. I can say the worst word because it's not considered as bad anymore.
Oh.
But it used to be the absolute worst thing you could say to someone. And that was the word damn.
Oh,
because damn,
we're damning someone.
Go to hell.
Yeah.
That was considered to be the worst thing you could say to someone, to wish hell on someone. And so they picked F, the F word, as a substitute for that in order to soften it. But then the role of those two words in English switched, and the F word became more taboo and the D word became less taboo. And so but I just find it interesting that there was an age where people were so pious that saying damn you was the worst possible thing you could say to anybody.
It is. Yeah, right. You can see that, especially among Puritans or whatnot, who are very alert for those kind of curses and things, that's a really harsh curse if you're going to curse someone.
Yeah,
That's funny.
It's like in the play Hamlet, where he is plotting revenge on his uncle, you know, for killing his father, and he comes across his uncle, and hey, it's a perfect opportunity. I could kill him right now, but his uncle is saying his prayers, And Hamlet wants his uncle to go to hell. Oh. So he's not going to kill him right now. And it's like, wow, Hamlet is cold.
What a jerk that Hamlet was. I'm sorry. Yeah. But get your act together, Hammy. Come on. All right. Do we ever get to Darren's question? Did we do it? No, we did.
Not yet.
Well, thanks for the question, Darren. We'll get to it next time. All right, here it is. Hello from the UK, Jimmy. What exactly is a doctor of the church? And why are their views held in higher esteem compared to any other theologian or apologist? Thanks.
Okay, so the term doctor is Latin for teacher. And so a doctor of the church is a teacher of the church, meaning of the whole church. They've made an important theological contribution in some form that that has brought notable insights to the attention of the Catholic Christian world. And when they're given the title doctor of the church, that wants to recognize them for the value of the insights they provided, and it also wants to popularize them. So there have been some doctors of the church that were not that well known here in the West, like most people have heard of some of the early big doctors like Augustine and Gregory the Great and people like that, and Thomas Aquinas. You know, they're well known, but they're are other doctors whose writings were known, but in a more restricted way. And by giving them the title doctor, it's kind of brought new attention to the valuable insights that they had. So an example of that would be Hildegard of Bingen. Mm-hmm. She was well known in some places, like in Germany, but not so much here in America. Another would be Gregory of Narenek. Who was known in some Eastern Catholic circles more, but not so much here in the West. So there's kind of, I guess it's kind of like one of those finger puzzles, you know, where you pull on it both ways. The title Doctor of the Church both acknowledges the contributions they have made, and it popularizes those contributions going forward. So the basic idea is that doctors of the church have made very insightful contributions to some area of theology. Doesn't mean the whole of theology. Some doctors of the church are known for contributions in particular areas, like Alphonsus Liguori is known for his contributions to moral theology. Now, he also did a lot of other work, like on Marian theology and stuff, but why he's a doctor is for his contributions to moral theology. Similarly, Teresa of Lisieux was known for her contributions to personal spiritual theology. Aquinas was known for his contributions to dogmatic theology. And so there are different doctors who have made contributions in different areas. One who I'm quite confident will be declared a doctor of the church, hopefully within my lifetime, is St. John Henry Newman. Because he was able to articulate the idea of doctrinal development in a way that it had not been articulated before, and that's provided an enormous service to the church to understand and explain how it's developed over time. And so I'm very confident now that he's been declared a saint that he will in short order also be declared a doctor of the church.
Darren. Thanks for the note from the UK. Hope we'll get more of those in the future. We'll take a very quick break and be right back with more Ask Me Anything Internet version with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
He was a 10th century saint, priest, mystic, and doctor of the church, honored as the first poet of Armenia.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Grigory of Narek is revered by Armenians as a watchful angel in human form. His masterwork, the Book of Lamentations, was intended to be his last testament, an encyclopedia of prayer for all nations. He was named a Doctor of the Church in 2015.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. When have I eaten a mung bean, Jimmy? So this is what we discussed during the breaks. And now Jimmy told me that I've eaten a mung bean, and I've never even heard of a mung bean. When did I eat a mung bean?
Well, you've almost certainly eaten them in their early sprouted form, because mung bean sprouts are among the most common forms. They're not the only forms of sprouts that are available commercially in supermarkets.
Oh, yeah,
but they are among the most common. And so if you've eaten sprouts, you've probably eaten mung bean sprouts.
Oh, all right. All right, I feel better about it. I thought I had done something bad by accident sometime, but all right, I've eaten. That's okay. I don't care about that. I've eaten sprouts, yeah. This next one comes from Jordan. What's a good way to explain why the Novus Ordo was introduced? How would you address critics of either the Novus Ordo or the traditional Latin Mass, and both forms should be respected?
Okay, so by the way, before I deal with Jordan's question, if you've ever seen those sprouts that are like the translucent tubes that are kind of crunchy,
yeah,
those are mung bean sprouts.
Oh yeah, I've definitely had those. My wife is crazy for sprouts. I get them on stuff that I didn't ask for them on, I can tell you that, but she loves them sprouts.
Okay, so what's a good way to explain why the Novus Ordo was introduced? Let's start there. The answer is that it was something, at least the seeds of this process, were something that were called for by the Second Vatican Council. The liturgy had remained largely, though not entirely, stable for a number of centuries. And one of the things that had happened over the course of centuries is that various elements had gotten added to the liturgy. And there was some feeling at the council that some of these elements are not really contributing that much to the experience of the liturgy itself and to the spiritual message of the liturgy. And it would be better if we simplified it and took out some of these things that had been added over the centuries. There was also a kind of, in the 60s, there was sort of a fad for early Christian liturgical expression. There had been a lot of new work done on, say, 4th century liturgies, and there was a desire to kind of retrieve some of the things from earlier in Christian history that had been lost over time. And so in the document Sacrosanctum Concilium, the Council Fathers called for a renewal of the liturgy. And this was then entrusted to a commission, which did some of the things that the Council Fathers requested, but it also went beyond what the Council Fathers requested. Now, some of the things that they ended up doing, like, for example, the Second Vatican Council called for greater use of the vernacular languages in the celebration of the liturgy. Previously, in the Latin Rite of the Church, it had all been in Latin. And most people didn't speak Latin anymore. And so there was a desire to encourage more use of the vernaculars, like English and Spanish and French and German and so forth. But they didn't want the whole thing in the vernacular. They specifically, you know, carved out certain things and said, like, we want people to be able to, you know, say or sing, you know, the common parts of the Mass that the people say in Latin, so like they do now. And so they were calling for a partial translation into the vernaculars. But what happened was, after the council, the Vatican Commission got lots of requests for, can we do the whole thing in the vernacular? And Pope Paul VI ended up signing off on that. So, you know, they kind of changed course a little bit after the council. The commission that was overseeing the revision of the liturgy also had its own ideas about things. One of these was what ended up giving us the four standard Eucharistic prayers that we have now. You know, there are other Eucharistic prayers as well, but four of them are kind of the main ones. And number one is the original Roman canon from the previous rite of Mass. And it's really saint heavy. You know, it names all these male saints and it names all these female saints. And in the conciliar period, in the older form of the Latin Mass, this one Eucharistic prayer had bunches of options for variants that would be used at different points in the year. Well, kind of the original idea was, if we're going to simplify the Mass and remove accretions that have been added to it over time, then you just simplify the Eucharistic prayer and make a simpler, streamlined version. But they didn't. They basically left Eucharistic prayer number one alone and didn't really modify it, and they added three more that are inspired by various other streams of Catholic tradition, like Eastern, you know, Catholic rites and so forth. And even just one of them is like a brand new composition, basically. So they went a bit beyond what the fathers of the council had asked for, but Pope Paul VI, who's now a saint, he approved it all. And there are reports that he wasn't always happy with everything that he himself had approved, but he did approve it. And so that's how we got the so-called Novus Ordo, or new order of Mass. That's the first question. The second question was, how would you address critics of either the Novus Ordo or the traditional Latin Mass, that both forms should be respected? Well, for critics of the traditional Latin Mass, I would say this was the church's liturgy for hundreds of years. You shouldn't be dissing this. You know, this was the core of Catholic life and spirituality for hundreds of years. Even if you think it could be improved by, you know, some of what was done more recently, it's still a holy and good thing in and of itself, and you shouldn't be hostile towards it. And if some people prefer it, you should respect those people and their liturgical sentiments. So that's what I'd say to critics of the traditional Latin Mass. I think it needs to be respected, and it's a holy and good thing that should be respected. When it comes to critics of the Novus Ordo, I would say, now, you know, in both of these discussions, we could get into the weeds, you know, the specific details of the two rites, but I'm trying to keep this at sort of a higher level here. But if someone's criticizing the Novus Ordo, I would say, you know, read it. There's nothing in there that's harmful. There's nothing in there that's bad. Some people have different liturgical sensibilities. They want to hear the liturgy in their native language. They don't have a problem with these prayers and the sometimes simplified way that they're done. Just because this is a different expression doesn't mean it's bad. The church already has lots of different expressions of the liturgy. It doesn't all have to be the traditional Latin Mass. We have the Eastern rites of the Catholic Church that have their own liturgical traditions. We, even in the West, have multiple versions of the Latin rite, like, for example, the Ambrosian rite that's used in Milan, or the Sarum rite that was used in England, or the Anglican use that's used today by those who have a connection with Anglican heritage. All of these are variants of the Latin rite itself. So it's not like there has to be rigid uniformity. That's never been the case. The church has always had liturgical diversity. And if some people appreciate the Novus Ordo version of the liturgy, which is valid, and it matches their preferences, well, then, you know, that's fine. They should be respected, and the Novus Ordo should be respected too.
Jordan, thank you. I'm going to move on and try to get some more questions on before we have to go. And Veronica wanted to know this. If after the resurrection we will be more like angels, does this imply we will be genderless as well?
I don't think we have a definitive answer to this, because Jesus doesn't tell us. What he tells us is in the resurrection, we're going to be like the angels in that we are not going to be married. And so that implies, in the biblical view, we're not going to be having sexual relations. But I don't think that that means we're going to be sexless. In the first place, the idea that angels are sexless is a more recent realization. If you go back into Second Temple Jewish literature, you're not going to find the idea that angels lack gender. That's a later realization that's based on theological reflection on the nature of angels as fundamentally bodiless creatures. But if you look at Second Temple literature, it portrays them as having gender. In fact, in the Book of Jubilees, there are several different classes of angels. Two of them are the closest to God. And those two classes of angels, in contrast to the rest, are circumcised. They were created circumcised, whereas all the other angels are created uncircumcised. And so, well, in order to be circumcised or uncircumcised, you need gender. So the idea that angels don't have gender is something that's familiar to us, and I think it's true. They don't, based on their nature. But the way people imagined them in the Second Temple period when Jesus lived, most people had not gotten to this point. And so the audience would not have understood Jesus to be saying that we're going to lose our gender. He's just saying we're not going to be married. And so, like I said, the church doesn't have a definitive teaching here. So if you wanted to propose we're going to be genderless, that's an interesting proposal. But I don't think it's very well sourced. I don't think it's implied by what Jesus said, because that's not how he would have been understood by his audience. And also, I think the church's current understanding of humanity is that our sexual identity is built into us, and it's so, you know, you Jimmy Akin is always a man, and Cy Kellett is always a man, and we're not going to lose any aspects of our fundamental identity in the resurrection. So I think that we will be like the angels in that we won't be married and thus won't be having sexual relations. But I think we will continue to be gendered creatures and thus reflect, though by our gender, reflect different aspects of God's creative glory.
Veronica, thanks. I want to get this next one on just because I want to say the name. Metagalaxy Go the Distance asked this, Jimmy. Recently, in one live stream, someone was saying Christianity spread with the Bible in one hand and a bullet in the other. What should be my response as a Christian?
Well, you're not going to get that far if in one of your hands you just have a bullet. You need a gun to throw the bullet.
You just throw it at somebody.
I didn't hear this live stream. I don't know who was involved, but they're trying to be facetious here. And if I peel back the facetiousness, I guess I'd say a few things. The first thing is, well, guns were not used in Europe until the 14th century. And Europe was already thoroughly Christianized by the 14th century. So obviously, bullets and guns did not play much of a role in the spread of Christianity. Also, the church, even though there has been force used to convert people, the church has always condemned that. So if you have missionaries in some places or non-missionaries in some places like conquistadors using force to convert people to the faith, they are breaking church teaching. They are violating what the church says needs to happen. And in the church's view, they're violating human rights and doing evil. So the church has always discouraged anything like that. Then there's the fact that the church spread in the age of persecutions, when Christianity was a periodically persecuted minority. You know, Christianity wasn't even legalized until the early 300s. And yet it grew so much even while it was being persecuted, that it became a powerful force in the empire that led to its legalization. And it obviously wasn't using force to convert people when Christians were the ones who had force being used against them. So those are the basic points I'd raise here.
Thank you, MetaGalaxy Go the Distance, for the excellent question. Jimmy Akin, thank you so much for the 2 hours as part of a multi-hour day of media appearances for you today.
My pleasure.
Check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mysterious.fm, wherever you get your podcasts, and of course on Jimmy's YouTube channel. Also, check out the Jimmy Akin podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on Jimmy's YouTube channel. That will do it for us. A very blessed feast of the Sacred Heart of Jesus to you. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.